Good afternoon, and thanks for tuning in to Faith and Reason. This is your host, Dr. John Pinero, and for the next hour, we're going to be talking about poetry, about why Catholics should read poetry, really why anyone should read poetry, why poetry isn't something just for the classroom or for literary critics, but the ways it speaks to us and the unique things about it, really. And maybe we'll definitely look into some prominent Catholic poets of our own day. And so to help us with this, I've invited as our guest Dr. James Matthew Wilson, who teaches in the Department of Humanities and Augustinian Traditions at Villanova University. Dr. Wilson is the author of Four Verse Letters, published by Steubenville Press, a chapbook of poems, and a critical introduction, a book on Timothy Steele, a critical introduction by Storyline Press. His poems and essays and reviews have appeared in a lot of places. I can mention a few here, in Modern Age, in First Things, in Chronicles, on Front Porch Republic Online, at the American Conservative, the Raintown Review. He is an award-winning scholar, and he's been at Villanova since, I believe, is it 2008? Okay, so welcome to the show, James.
Thanks for having me, John.
James and I first met at the Russell Kirk Center for Cultural Renewal right here in Michigan, in Mecosta, Michigan, I think. It may have been around 2008. I'm not sure when that was, but it feels like quite a while ago now. But you sure are thriving at Villanova, it seems. Your output is amazing, I think. And I think to me it's impressive as a fellow scholar and professor to look at your literary output.
Oh, thanks for saying that. I went into academia wanting to be a teacher, but I think somewhere in my heart it was always the dream of being a writer first. And so every chance I get, I'm sitting down and writing something.
Well, I didn't see it listed in your biography, but I thought I remembered you writing a column for quite a while for the ISI online journal. What's the name of that online journal on government and politics?
The journal was First Principles.
First Principles, that's right.
Column was called The Treasonous Clerk.
Yeah, The Treasonous Clerk. You had a whole series there. I greatly enjoyed those. Dr. Wilson has this PhD in English Literature and Irish Studies from the University of Notre Dame, and did his MFA also at Notre Dame in creative writing and poetry, but previous work at the University of Massachusetts and also at the University of Michigan. And so what we're here to talk about today is poetry, and I'll just start off by saying why should the average person, once they're done with school, once they've been given the poems that they're told they have to read in English classes along the way and snippets of poems and not even allowed to read complete poems, why should we as adults read poetry?
Okay, well, there are a range of directions that we could take to come into that. It would be sort of a delight if we could say that most people actually had to suffer through poetry through their school years. That's increasingly rare. But it's probably worth mentioning that, say, 100 years ago, and going back from there, the average child's education would have consisted largely or mostly of poetry. Why was it so central? Because poetry was the refined speech of every language. And so by studying poetry, by memorizing it, human beings sort of came to embody perfected rhythms, and their own speech was improved thereby. You see that every once in a while, if you get a chance to look at older letters, especially letters from the 19th century, they often tend to be just sort of crammed with quotation and allusion, and it's not because of some sort of literary pretension on the part of the average letter writer. It's because one learned to write by apprenticing oneself to the great poet, and by, as I said a second ago, by sort of embodying their language. I'm not quite sure that we're ever done perfecting our own language, so as a merely utilitarian purpose, it might be well worth somebody reading poetry throughout their whole life long. But there's something more to it than that, and I've got a few things I might want to say in that direction, but I think I'll start with just one for you. And that's the way in which poetry is a kind of spiritual, intellectual, and aesthetic, and even moral discipline. The great poet Ivor Winters, who was a tremendous influence on me, both as a critic and a poet, when I was first reading poetry and taking interest in it, he thought of poetry as one of the foremost disciplines for the person who would be intelligent. Because on the one hand, we respond immediately and intuitively to the beauty of well-constructed language. But the act of constructing that language, of bringing it together, involves some pretty serious mathematical and rational intelligence, sort of discipline the syllables to measure them, put them into meter, to find suitable and interesting rather than banal rhymes. But this sort of basic encounter with the surface and the auditory qualities of language is really sort of just an initiation into the even deeper mental discipline of imagining something concretely, reflecting on it with care, and then finally training your emotions or your will to sort of respond to those, to what you've just reflected on, in an appropriate way. Winters saw poetry as a great way to do this, and he thought every person who wanted to live well should spend his life submitting himself to the discipline of good poetry. I think I'll stop there. There's so much more to add, I suppose.
Well, so when you say submitting yourself to the discipline, you mean reading, or both reading and writing of poetry? So we're growing up, and maybe we're starting out even with a nonsense verse just to train our ears, or starting out with the Mother Goose rhymes, let's say, to just train our ears to hear the rhythms of language. But are we talking about reading and hearing, or writing, or all three?
Indeed, it is all three. I began my comment with talking about children's education in poetry and sort of left it implicit there. But of course, you begin to read poetry in order to memorize it, to take it into yourself, so that it can, as it were, train or initiate or discipline you and train your mind. But that should in turn find some kind of expression in your improved ability to write, to speak well, and even to compose poetry. Nobody has to aspire to become a professional poet, and I certainly never did, in order to write a decent poem. It's one of the joys, I must say, when I teach my Art of Verse class here at Villanova, seeing how many students finish the semester capable of writing maybe not a great work of literature that needs to be published or given a major award, but a good sonnet that captures something distinct about human experience and does so in sharp language and maybe with a witty rhyme. This is something that I think everybody should, there's a power I think everybody should possess. Who we all speak, why not speak well and learn how to master our tongue?
Would a student coming into your classroom, you think, this is just a general question about creative writing in general, would they already have to possess that imagination you talk about that's trained by poetry, yes, but trained by lots of things in a sense of wonder, among other things? Would they have to already have that imagination to produce something worthwhile, as you mentioned? I mean, can you teach somebody that in a semester?
Well, I don't try terribly hard to teach that. I try to teach them the craft and tradition of poetry. Poetry is our oldest art form. It could be our oldest continuous tradition, by which I mean to say that a poet reading today, or the average person reading today, still has something to learn about the art of poetry from reading Homer. I have a great deal of fact to learn from Homer. And certainly, it's been a continuous tradition since Homer 3,000 years ago up until the present of people trying to master and measure speech into verses. When I teach creative writing to my students, I actually try to minimize the preparation they would have to have imaginatively. A lot of the early exercises I give them are purely trying to help them get a hold on the way in which speech rhythms work. So I'll have them, for instance, write a series of casual sentences in iambic pentameter. I'm forgetting my example off the top of my head, but when I share with the students, begins with something like the toilet is plugged up again or something like that.
Okay.
And then you go from there. I'll have them, at some point early in the semester, write a rhymed ballad. Usually I will send, this is an exercise I got from Dana Gioia, actually. I'll send them either to the pages of the old grocery store tabloids or to the pages of that comic newspaper, The Onion, and ask them to just take a story from there and put it into a rhymed ballad. So they're not, at least at first, really trying to imagine the way we usually think of imagination, as in creating a story and characters or a whole scenario out of nothing. They're drawing on something that's already existent and trying to add their own particular understanding and measured speech to it. And that, they really delight in that because, first of all, it's not just simply because it takes a little pressure off them to have to think something up, but because it really is quite a challenge to find just the right way to capture, some absurd story about, say, a husband being left alone and having to feed himself. To use one example from one of my students.
What shaped your understanding of the possibilities of poetry? You said you never really thought about being a professional poet by any means, but when did you just first discover that you had a talent for poetry, and what really shaped your approach to that? There must have been some great poets that you read, perhaps, or maybe it was a particular schooling or a family member.
I was thinking about this earlier today. It was very much schooling. I was thinking earlier today because I don't know if you know the writer Rod Dreher, but he's been writing quite a bit about Dante's Divine Comedy and how it's changed his life, and he's even proposed writing a book about Dante's comedy.
I read his Crunchy Cons. I think that's the last thing of his I probably read.
I'd like to read this book on Dante if it ever gets written. It was Dante who changed my life. I went to the University of Michigan in hopes of writing novels, so I did have dreams of writing, but I didn't envision that would be a career. My hope for a career was going to be something in politics, so I intended to study political economy, and having gone through the basic economic requirements, I finally enrolled in a class in political economy or international economy, and I thought I've arrived at my career and my vocation's dream. I sat through one class session, received the syllabus, and there was nothing wrong with it, but somewhere in my heart I thought, this doesn't seem right. And I just instinctively went back to my dorm room and disenrolled from the class and enrolled in a class on Dante's Divine Comedy. And for the next 4 months, I spent hours every night reading that poem and the commentary on it. And it was my introduction to a whole range of things, only one of them being truly great epic poetry in the Christian tradition. It was Dante's poem is a poem that seems to hold the whole universe together. And so it was my introduction to serious Catholic theology. It was an introduction for me to ancient philosophy and ancient mythology, not to mention church history. And ever since I read the comedy, it has shaped a great many of the major life decisions I have taken in very direct ways. I'm sure it's no mistake that I spent the last 15 years of my career studying the interrelation of philosophical theology and poetry, because I encountered all three of those things in the same place in Dante in my late teens. So Dante was the decisive influence.
Well, I don't think you could pick a bigger influence than Dante. That's it's great to hear that about Dante. Dante is assigned in the humanities program at Aquinas College, where I teach. From time to time, I get to teach in the humanities class, and when I do, the student, one of their complaints on the evals that I always take as a compliment is, Dr. Pinero makes us read more Dante than the other professors. But you know, of course, there's a reason for that. You know, I don't want them to miss any part of the story just by reading the Inferno.
Right.
So I wanted to give them as much of the Purgatorio and Paradiso as I can. In what ways, when you mention philosophical theology and poetry and the Christian tradition, the mm-hmm. show Faith and Reason here, one of the things we try to do is just show Catholics and others who are not Catholic just how deep and wide the Catholic tradition is. And not just its artistic and aesthetic tradition, but primarily its intellectual tradition. But Dante did something amazing by putting the medieval synthesis into poetry in the way that a medieval cathedral could do. You know, I mean, in a way that's very different than the works of Thomas Aquinas, for instance. And I wonder now then in the modern world, and this is the main reason we had you on the program today, James, was to talk about what is there especially about the Catholic worldview that ought to attract Catholics to read more poetry? Outside the poetry that's in the Bible, I mean specifically. What is it about that worldview? Why should Catholics read more poetry?
Well, if I can start at the height of abstraction, I'll say that one of the most powerful testimonies to the universality of the Catholic Church, that is to say, that it's not only a church that calls all people, but that it holds all things together and all things that are good are reconcilable to it. It's a way in which it recognizes that truth and goodness are one with beauty in the being of things. So I'm teaching a class on this now as it happens. The truth, goodness, and beauty are called the properties of being. Everything that is, insofar as it is true, it's good, and it's also beautiful. And so our natural desire for what's good and our reasoned sense of a kind of unqualified obligation to what is true finds a great echo in the sort of simple and pure delight of desire and intellect in whatever is beautiful. Whenever we see or hear something beautiful, we respond to it. And we respond to it as not something nice and irrelevant, although we can retrospectively call it that. We respond to it as a reality that we've just encountered. When we encounter something beautiful, we sense it, and that sense is not a deception. It's just one of the several pathways human beings take to really enter into the heart of the mystery of things. So you mentioned the Psalms. I'd say that's one reason that the Catholic liturgy is so inspired to give such a prominent place to the Psalms at the heart of the Mass, or at least at the heart of the Liturgy of the Word. So what are the Psalms but words whose primary purpose is not to convey doctrine the way a pack horse might convey bags full of coal out of down the trail, but it's to give thanks and to express joy at the beauty of creation and at the gift of life. In St. Augustine's Confessions, you probably know this well, every book is interrupted at least once, usually several times, by Augustine suddenly imitating the Psalms or writing his own psalm. And it's as if he's saying that the culmination of his life story, the culmination of all of his deep theological, moral, and philosophical reflections, the culmination of all these things is this kind of timeless lyric expression of thanks that we see the prototype of in the Psalms. Catholicism's universality and the place that it gives to beauty is the way in which our churches, whether they're ornate or austere, whether they're sort of Gothic or brutally modern, the way they nonetheless always foreground that appearance matters, that what we see that our encounter with beauty in any shape or sound tells us something about the nature of reality. We don't merely see and recognize appearances in order to get past them. We try to enter through them in order to perceive a reality that hasn't yet fully appeared. And so if this is the case, that is to say, if beauty is one of the three qualities of being, and our encounter with beauty is therefore one of the three ways we encounter reality and ultimately encounter and experience God, then it should have, the works of the beautiful should have a prominent place in the life of every Catholic. All the more so because human beings are overall quicker to and more readily pleased by an encounter with the beautiful than they often are with an encounter with truth, which can be difficult, or the good, which can often seem more elusive than an encounter with beauty.
This leads us into then talking about whom should Catholics read? Let's say you take somebody who said, you probably heard this before. I don't like poetry. I've never liked poetry. I haven't really found a poet that speaks to me. I mean, maybe you get students like this. Maybe you've talked to folks like this. To somebody who's not used to reading poetry or listening to it, and maybe we could talk about the difference between hearing and reading poetry, but who would you tell them to read? Who should a Catholic start off with, besides, of course, your works?
Well, that was a good suggestion you made, but I'd certainly, amongst contemporary poets, I'd begin by mentioning the poet Dana Gioia. I've written about Gioia before, and in fact intend to write more substantially about his career down the road, because he's such a versatile poet. If you open up a book of Gioia's poetry, you'll find short stories in verse, you will find lyric poems and elegies, you will also find songs, poems that are immediately exciting, not because they're profound or complex, but because they combine sort of striking and ingenious imagery with rhythms that are irresistible and immediate. It's important to recognize that poetry, most of the time, anyhow, gives us a sort of initial pleasure in its beauty, and then its beauty simply grows as we sort of enter more deeply into it. The experience, of course, that most people have of poetry, at least in our day, is poetry in the wake of T.S. Eliot. T.S. Eliot was a poet who believed that, at least in his day, but not on a permanent basis, poetry had to be difficult to reflect the bizarre complexities and difficulties of the modern condition. All of that makes sense, but Eliot didn't mean in the process for people to turn away from very accessible poetry like that of Longfellow or Wordsworth or Robert Browning. And so I think in our day, actually, we're finally experiencing a sort of return of poets who are writing both very sophisticated and well-crafted works, but ones that are readily accessible on a first reading. So I mentioned Dana's work. I'd mentioned Timothy Steele, on whom I've written a short book. No one can sit down and read a Timothy Steele poem and be intimidated by it. The poems are written in an incredibly familiar voice, and they're often on familiar scenes. And the voice is very straightforward, not to say simplistic. He's an incredibly complex poet, but he's very careful to maintain sort of accessible surfaces of his poetry. Other examples of great or at least worthwhile living poets would be more difficult would be the English poet Geoffrey Hill, who's considered one of our great religious poets, great Christian poets of our age. And a poet with whom I've spent a great deal of time, whose work and whose mind I've spent a great deal of time with, is that of Helen Pinkerton, who is in her 80s now, but is still writing poems. And she's one of the great Catholic poets of our age. She's published very few poems, but those she has published in a very austere and stately language adapt, amongst other things, the thought of Thomas Aquinas into verse. So there are a few names for you.
Well, thank you very much. I know Pinkerton had some very good things to say on the cover of your new book, The Violent and the Fallen, your latest collection of poems. She was one of your blurb writers there, saying that James Matthew Wilson's poems are those of a searching, philosophical, and subtle mind, treating themes of the inner and outer life of our contemporary world. And it's good to learn more about her. Now, if we were to talk about poets no longer living, maybe just a couple to throw in there, some Catholic poets. I guess Gerard Manley Hopkins would probably make the list. And who else? Anybody besides Hopkins?
No, an Anglo-Catholic, not a Roman Catholic. Mm-hmm. T.S. Eliot and Hopkins would be certainly among the foremost to read.
So is Eliot one of these honorary Catholics like C.S. Lewis, who seems to possess so much of the Catholic imagination? We kind of lump him in there when we talk about the Catholic imagination.
That seems to be the case, and it should be. Mm-hmm. Eliot did visit with Pius XII and have an audience with Pius XII, and Pope Pius gave him two rosaries, and Eliot gave one rosary away to a friend of his, and kept the rosary and prayed it every day for the rest of his life. I think that's worth something. The 20th century was full of with great poets who, though sometimes difficult, like Eliot, are often immediately beautiful to the ear. I have to mention W.H. Auden, not quite as magnificent a poet as Eliot, but in some way with a more sympathetic and friendly mind, and his poetry is very easy to find your way into.
Mm-hmm.
A poet who was certainly an anti-Catholic, in fact, seems to have believed in absolutely nothing, but captured the mundanity of the human experience in a wonderful way, and had a wonderful ear for meter and rhyme with the English poet Philip Larkin. Sort of an heir to Auden and Eliot, though not as accomplished intellectually or spiritually. And of course, you could go back farther still. The two great English poets of the 17th century, who were probably the most profound thinkers on the relation of the world to God, would be George Herbert and John Donne.
We were speaking of Gioia earlier, Dana Gioia, last name spelled G-I-O-I-A, if anybody out there wanted to Google him and go from there. But Gioia wrote an article recently in First Things called The Catholic Writer Today, in which the premise for his article was that, I'll quote him, he said there was almost no positive presence in the American fine arts of Catholics today, and how not only different that is in the last two millennia, but then the 20th century that you're talking about, up through the 50s, 1950s and 1960s, all over the various places in the American fine arts, you could find Catholics, and that these Catholic writers were his concern. It wasn't so much that their work was explicitly religious, but it really did stem from a Catholic worldview. Would you agree with that? And do you have an explanation for that? That is this
yes.
Lack of okay.
Certainly. Writing in the just before the First World War, T.S. Eliot, who was then a graduate student in philosophy at Harvard, living I guess he was in England, so I guess it was the beginning of the First World War, wrote a short book review of a manual of scholastic philosophy. It was a manual that was used for seminarians at the Catholic University of Louvain in Belgium. And he reviewed it for the Journal of Philosophy, and he begins the review by saying, the Catholic Church is the only church that can even make pretense of having a true philosophy. This was right at the outset of World War I, and it was almost a prophetic thing to say. For within 2 decades, the most dynamic and compelling intellectual figures in England and America and in France and in Germany were all Catholics. In the wake of the First World War, the world was seemed to be continuing to fall apart precipitously, and here Catholics were entering into the public square with the sort of confidence that comes from having a sort of thoroughgoing worldview formed in the hands of not only the church as a whole, but in the hands of St. Thomas Aquinas. And so they were confidently moving into public questions and attaining a certain degree of intellectual authority. There was only a slight delay from that development to Catholic artists sort of following in on their coattails and also coming to prominence. So Joya mentions in his article in particular, I think he quotes her several times, the great novelist and short story writer Flannery O'Connor, who, of course, continues to be an extremely prominent writer in our day. My students, I was just teaching a couple of her stories last semester in a class called Epiphanies of Beauty, and several of my students said that Flannery O'Connor was the one author we read that they would go back and read again and again and again.
Wow. That's great. Good. Wait, O'Connor is assigned in our Catholic studies, our Catholic writers class as part of Catholic studies at Aquinas, assigns O'Connor. And the students, they find her dark, and there's a lot of questioning about just how is she a Catholic writer, which gives a great avenue, of course, to talk about just what it means to be a Catholic writer or not. What do we really mean by that?
Well, I had something to... a short letter in the next issue of First Things magazine responding to that aspect of Joya's essay. In his essay, he very attractively paints the Catholic imagination as one that sees the world sort of coruscating with the sacramental. Right. God is the author of all things, and all things are intelligible to us. They speak to us. All things are sort of telling us in some small, sometimes hidden way the truth about God, the truth about reality. And yet in a writer like Flannery O'Connor, actually, the world looks utterly bereft of grace, bereft of the love that brought it into being in the first place. And when love and grace finally do appear, as they do at the end of the story, A Good Man Is Hard to Find, it's in a grandmother who's afraid, in the form of a grandmother who's fearful of her life and is breaking down in tears because she's about to be robbed, and she finally reaches her hand across to the man who's pointing a gun at her and says, "You could have been one of my children. You're just one of my babies." An act of absolute love and compassion and grace, and of course the robber's so startled that he steps back a pace and then shoots her 3 times in the chest. In Flannery O'Connor's imagination, her very in its own way a very Catholic imagination, the one news to tell about the world is that it's going to crucify Jesus again every chance it gets. So it is very dark, but it's also an insight into the sort of continuing presence, and it offers an insight into the continuing presence of grace in the world. Sometimes it's the grace that we refuse.
Well, I would hate to complete the show without actually maybe reading some poetry on the air, maybe from one of the people you mentioned, maybe one of your own poems from Violent and the Fallen. I was reading through your book, which arrived just a couple days ago, and I was particularly taken by Some Permanent Things. Actually, the first, I think that's the first poem in the book, In the Immigrant serving maid in Dublin, which made me think you've actually been to Dublin. I recall spending a semester in Ireland with Aquinas students in 2007, and the students were all very excited to go to Dublin, and when they got there, it was difficult to find somebody who'd been born in Ireland. We had just not imagined such an international city prior to going there. And just reading the last two lines of that poem where you write that she's been born here not on wings of desire, but just to work and send home cash by wire. And I thought that just in those two lines encapsulating what's a very controversial issue in America, immigration and why people do it. And it's usually not for fun, and people don't leave their homes for very light or simple reasons, do they? It's usually very complex motives behind that, but mainly to give your family a better life, I think. But this is just to send home cash by wire, you say. Well, what would you like to read for us? Would you like to do that?
Well, let me read for you, if I could, a poem from closer to the end of the book called A Prayer for Livia Grace. Livia Grace is my daughter, my first child. She features in several of my poems. Now, none of my poems are ever strictly biographical, even if they are autobiographical. If I happen to be writing about myself in some way, I'll often throw in something that's not actually true just to give myself a little distance. Mm-hmm. I want to write poems. I don't want to write a journal entry. though I have to say this poem pretty much adheres to the truth. It's a festina, which I should say a few words about that. In English, the traditional fixed form, that is to say a poem that has a fixed number of lines, is always the sonnet. Everybody knows that because everybody's had to read at least one of Shakespeare's sonnets in school. And the sonnet really is the great form in English. It's so logically perfect in its size and scope that, that it's the natural fixed form for us. But the festina is a much more complicated fixed form. It involves stanzas with six lines. We have to repeat the end or rhyme words from each stanza over the course of all six stanzas and then repeat them in the final three lines. It's very complicated. A lot of poets only write it because, write festinas because they're difficult. I swore I would never write one because I didn't see the point in writing anything just because it was hard. But then finally I got sick of reading festinas that didn't follow all the rules. I thought I better show people how it's done. And, my daughter Olivia was just born, 3 months earlier, and my office at home was also her bedroom, so I didn't have much space to myself.
Yeah.
And that seemed to be a pretty instructive moral lesson for me, the way in which your life is changed by your children, and you accept the sort of confinement of small room cramped with toys and cribs in a way that you might not have before. So I'll just go ahead and read this, if I may.
Please.
A Prayer for Livia Grace. There's little room left in this house for poetry, or in this world for any lasting language. The managers and sales reps at the office who've ticketed their holidays are childless and looking toward 5 days of sun and liquor. They care for neither of books or a young daughter. But somehow, near me sleeps an infant daughter who grows still to the cradle sounds of poetry, eyelids dropped in the promise of sweet liquor. It charms her, yet she knows nothing of language. Nor did I, in a way, when I was childless, preoccupied with filling another office than fatherhood. Now, crowded in my office, a crib and chest of pink drawers for my daughter remind me that this empty room sat childless except for those ink-littered cheeks of poetry, when child was just a word and my child language, which I would write and read at night with liquor. Now she's born. We have little time for liquor, and my desk crammed in a corner of the office, my papers lost beneath the brighter language of cardboard-colored alphabets for my daughter. I'm sure I wrote a different kind of poetry when all my hours were filled, though I was childless. The TV news shows that, because they're childless, exercise and avoid cigarettes and liquor, modern consumers live a life of poetry, controlled and self-absorbed as fits the office of sonnets or festinas, their only daughter an iPod or other ephemeral techno-language. I pray, my daughter, speak another language, that, in the richest sense, you not be childless, your every act a kind of laughing daughter more beautiful than bored clerks at their liquor. Though they may find no room for it at the office, may you crowd your small corridors with poetry. My daughter's teething needs her gums rubbed with liquor, which stops my language, calls me from my office. I go. May I have more of this child, less poetry.
Thank you very much, James.
Oh, you're welcome.
That's the prayer for Livia Grace from The Violin and the Fallen, James Matthew Wilson reading his own poetry here on Faith and Reason. I have a 9-month-old daughter at home who is our only child. And I can, when I read a poem like that, and I imagine the way she's changed our lives, certainly. And we had quite a few years with no children in the home. So we developed maybe, I'm not sure about our respective ages, but we had a lot more habits for a child to enter into and change those and reprioritize things as we hope she would. But it's amazing how quickly the priorities changed and for the better, really. So that's a powerful poem. I thank you for reading it.
You're welcome.
Now I think we have time for maybe one from. Did you have anything from Hopkins or Pink? You mentioned Pinkerton at the ready. If you don't, that's fine.
I do.
Okay.
Here I'll give you a poem called Herein and Harvest from Hopkins. Poem. I mentioned at the start of this interview the way in which beauty is an encounter with reality. And Hopkins, like any good Victorian, loved landscapes, farmland landscapes in particular. So in Herein and Harvest, he starts describing walking amid the harvest scenery of the English countryside, and he realizes that there's a presence, the presence of God visible within these things. And all that was lacking were the eyes of faith necessary to perceive within the surfaces of things the depths of their divine meaning. So here we are. Summer ends now. Now barbarous in beauty, the stooks rise around. Up above, what wind walks, what lovely behavior of silk-sack clouds has wilder, wilful, wavier meal drift molded ever and melted across skies. I walk. I lift up. I lift up heart, eyes, down all that glory in the heavens to glean our Savior. And eyes, heart, what looks, what lips yet gave you a rapturous love's greeting of realer, of rounder replies. And the azure-hung hills are his world-wielding shoulder, majestic, as a stallion stalwart, very violent, sweet. These things were here, and but the beholder wanting, which too, when they once meet, the heart rears wings bold and bolder, and hurls for him, oh, half hurls earth for him off under his feet. That's Herein Harvest.
Thank you. Now we have a lecture series in town here called Authenticum, and we've had the gentlemen who run this lecture series on Mike Tober and Mark Postma, and I know one of their speakers in fall of 2014 is going to be speaking on Hopkins, actually, a gentleman here locally who, with me, did the inaugural lecture. I'll tell you what we did. Maybe you could tell me what you think of this, James. For the inaugural lecture, they said, what would you like to do? I said, well, how about this? And I said, Catholic Studies at Aquinas College will co-sponsor it. Why don't we get somebody to read Lepanto by G.K. Chesterton? But before that, I'll give a lecture, just kind of the boring history lecture, right? I'm going to lay out the history and the facts, and then we can see at the same time what happens when a poet takes hold of these so-called facts and what we know about a battle like that and what they can turn that into many years after the fact, of course, a few hundred years after the fact. by all accounts, it was a pretty successful night. I mean, I think the reader, Steve Ayers of the poem, gets most of the credit. Maybe Chesterton deserves even more, of course, since he wrote it. But it was a great night to look out and see an audience of like 100 people just listening to poetry. And I wonder if there's – if we can still encounter poetry outside of the classroom or the book – that is reading poetry. Where can we go to hear poetry? I'd like to think today on the radio in Grand Rapids on Faith and Reason, only on Holy Family Radio, is today somebody hearing a poem read on air. I should say, maybe I shouldn't like to think that, but I think that's probably the case. But how important do you think is hearing poetry of the kind you just read to us from yourself and from Hopkins?
I think you do have to hear it. Poetry, even the fact that poetry has line breaks, which are intended not to do nothing other than to help you detect how the meter works so you can count it more effectively, even the line breaks that you see on the page actually make it harder for the average person to read the poem. It seems like such a small thing, but I think it's significant. When you hear that poetry is really written for the voice, whether it's the voice, the inner ear, or the literal ear, it opens up the reality of this art form, and you suddenly can understand why it is not only the oldest of the arts, but has always been, or had always been, up until very recently, considered the chief of the arts. Now, of course, in our day, I think they have polls and studies about these things, that maybe 1% of all Americans, or even smaller than that, read poetry with any regularity outside of school. And you can understand why that is, given how crowded our lives are with media of every sort, many of which are easier to watch or to encounter with a container of popcorn in your hand than poetry is. But I think when people really hear poetry read well, they know that they're in the presence of something great. Years ago, I used to spend my summers in Ireland. I lived for 4 or 5 years. And there was a fellow who had mastered the poetry of W.B. Yeats, who truly had one of the greatest poetic voices of the last century. And this fellow, he had designed a one-hour play where he would just recite the poetry of Yeats, interspersing it with some of Yeats's prose writings that sort of explained the poetry. So it sounded kind of like your typical contemporary poetry reading, but with the late Yeats's poetry in it. I remember sitting in a crowded room. There were maybe 50, 60 people present. And when this man began speaking, the poetry of Yeats was so beautiful and brilliant in his voice, that no one moved for an hour. And that was maybe a self-selecting audience, but I suspect that kind of thing could happen all the time. Certainly, I can see it happening with Chesterton's Lepanto, which is such a powerful, rhythmic, rocking beast of a poem that it would be hard not to fall in love with it right away.
Yeah, I mean, my blood was stirring just listening to it, and it was a great evening. I wonder whether John Paul II ever wrote any poetry. Do you know if he was?
He was prolific.
I thought he had, but I couldn't. I can't think of one poem he wrote offhand, except for some prayers, I guess, which might count in that category. But I know he also wrote that letter to artists, and I'm sure you're familiar with all of that. Is there anything we'd have to learn from soon to be St. John Paul about poetry?
Quite a bit. It's hard to say about the specific techniques of poetry because the translations of his work into English don't strike me as that well done.
Okay.
But there are translations, and in fact, just this last semester in the same course where I was teaching Flannery O'Connor, my students read John Paul II's verse drama, The Jeweler's Shop, which was for many of my students the favorite work of the semester because it's such a penetrating account of love and marriage can be expected from John Paul II, who was such a great influence on young married couples in Poland and helping them prepare for their weddings and life thereafter. The best of his poems that I know, and I'm forgetting the title, I must say, is one on the nature of work. And it reflects on his experience working as a forced laborer during the Nazi occupation of Poland, where he was breaking stones in a quarry. Oh, well, yeah, the poem's called The Quarry, now that I think about it. And what's so stunning about the poetry is, first of all, it's just very intriguing poetry. One of the lines is, the greatness of work is within man. And these reflections on the experience of working in a quarry that the young John Paul II wrote as poetry later found expression in his important encyclical on labor, Laborum Exercens. So far as I know, he's the first pope to work out some of his magisterial teachings in verse first. Although I just recently read some translations of a poem by Pius X, so he's not the first poet, pope to write poetry.
Do you know if any of John Paul's poetry, are those collected at all?
There's a collected bilingual edition.
Okay.
And then Ignatius Press publishes The Jeweler's Shop, and in a very expensive edition that I've not yet been able to acquire, the University of California Press years ago collected all of his verse dramas, his plays, and his writings on theater. So they're all out there and available, though not always easy to come by.
Right. Those are for university libraries to buy, perhaps, those expensive books.
That's right.
Just to get back in our closing minutes here, I think we have about 5-10 minutes left, something like that. And we had talked about the Catholic writer, and I know that terminology. You could be a Catholic who writes poetry, and you could be a poet who is Catholic but doesn't conceive of himself that way. And I suspect you think of yourself as a Catholic writer, but I'm wondering a different question. In what ways would you resist that label? Is there any way in which you would resist that label, James Matthew Wilson, the Catholic poet?
There is a way. Though I have written devotional poems, in fact, I just completed a Stations of the Cross sequence, the first couple of which will be appearing in First Thing soon, and the rest are in production elsewhere. So I've written devotional poetry, and I've written poems that are sort of integrated into the liturgical calendar. The title poem of my new book, The Violent and the Fallen, or rather that title, comes from a poem called The Second Week of Advent, or The Second Sunday of Advent. We have two Advent poems, still working on the other two.
I was wondering where the rest of Advent was when I was reading through your book here. So,
part three has 8 lines written. They've been okay. Sitting there written for about 3 years. Someday.
Mm-hmm.
I keep moving on to other projects. But there's one way in which I would resist, and I want to be thought of as a Catholic poet in the way Dante was. That is to say, somebody who describes the world with precision within that comprehensive vision of things that only the Catholic Church makes possible. Everything else is partial compared to what you can see from the perspective of Catholic faith. And that includes giving a sort of depth to the moral dimension of human life, as well as a breadth to the vision of creation and the cosmos as all something that was created by divine truth and divine love. What I try to avoid, or rather I don't have to try to avoid it, it just doesn't come naturally to me, is overly saturating my poetry in just the furniture and fashions of and language of Catholic liturgical life. And that's not, I don't avoid it. I've written quite a few poems like that. There's one called At Father Max Wake in the new book. In my first book, Four Verse Letters, there's a whole section of it situated at Mass down in North Carolina, where we were living, and the experience of attending Mass with a bunch of Baptists who have converted to Catholicism was a unique experience for me, a native Michigander. But I would want the Catholicism to be reflected more in the depth and the breadth of the vision of the poem than in some kind of shibboleth of particular items. The other extreme that I try to avoid, and I think Flannery O'Connor maybe went to this extreme, and she seldom represents a Catholic, but there are a few stories where she represents Catholics, like the Enduring Chill, which is a priest who's like Teilhard de Chardin. I don't want to make the lived reality, the quotidian reality of Catholic life invisible in my poetry, because it's so much a part of my daily life, but I don't want it to take over so that that the reader would encounter a world that he can't recognize as his own, or that of the average person.
No, I see the a great difference between people I would think are great Catholic novelists like Evelyn Waugh and Graham Greene in their works, or Flannery O'Connor, of course, who we mentioned. There's a great difference between their works, let's say, and the works of somebody who's really writing devotional or didactic literature, or really kind of an idealized story for children, let's say. And even those kind of movies don't have as much appeal to me as something that is maybe saturated with the Catholic worldview, but it's very implicit, perhaps, in the work, or it's here or it's there. And I at least seem to appreciate that more. And the same I would say for most poetry. I mean, I do enjoy the devotional type, of course, in the Psalms, but what you're describing, I think, is as much Catholic poetry as anything else. So.
Right. Yeah, well, the two great American poets, Alan Pace and Robert Lowell, both Catholic converts, in Pace's poetry, there's absolutely nothing on the surface of things that would indicate that he's a Catholic poet, with maybe the exception of he wrote some sonnets for Christmas. That's the title of one series of poems. But the vision of reality, as it were, is a sort of 20th century Dante's vision of things. Robert Lowell, when he was a young and devout Catholic convert, I would say Catholicism is nowhere on the surface of his poetry, but it really penetrates and gives depth to his vision of things. Whereas, in his most famous book, Life Studies, at that point he had lost his faith and was swiftly moving out of the church. And it's only there that you find him explicitly talking about the details and the facts of Catholic life. There's a poem, I think it might be the opening poem in Life Studies, where he's crossing the Alps right at the time of the declaration of the Assumption, the declaration of the doctrine of the Assumption. And so, but it's at that point that he's sort of Catholicism has become visible to him in a new way, because he has himself lost his faith. And so it's a less Catholic poetry than the poems where Catholicism was an invisible presence just beneath the surface.
Well, this is Dr. John Pinheiro, and we've been listening and talking with Dr. James Matthew Wilson from Villanova University, poet, literary critic, and essayist, and also author of a new collection of poems called The Violent and the Fallen, which I would recommend folks read. And I want to thank you, Dr. Wilson, for being on the program, for reading us some poetry, for introducing us to people like Hopkins and Pinkerton and your own poetry, and talking about some of these other folks. Really appreciate your time today.
Well, thanks very much, John. I'm glad to be here.
Thank you very much. Have a good day.
You've been listening to Faith and Reason with your host, Dr. John Pinheiro, on Holy Family Radio. If you'd like to listen to this program again or share it with a friend, audio copies are available online at holyfamilyradio.net. Dr. John Pinheiro is Professor of History and Director of Catholic Studies at Aquinas College in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Faith and Reason is brought to you by Holy Family Radio. I'm your program producer, Michael Fiorenzo. Join us next time as we connect the riches of the Catholic intellectual tradition to daily life. Thanks for listening.